Hello, everyone, and welcome to 2022's last episode of the year. Yes, sir, Hater, my name is Mark, and as always, I'm with...
Yes, it's me, Dennis, and it's been a couple of weeks, Mark, so ready to go.
Well, have you been watching the football?
Well, yeah, I've watched every game, more or less. Bit disappointed with the England result, but that's football, isn't it?
Yeah, it all comes down to the fine margins if you want to win the World Cup.
Mm.
Yeah, and it's and we are literally just possibly 2 days away from the World Cup final, where we will get to watch Messi probably winning his one and only World Cup. And yeah, so who knows, right? It could be France retaining World Cup, and no country has actually retained the World Cup in 60 years. So what's your frame? Who's going to win the World Cup?
50-50 call. Yeah, absolutely. It will be that close. Whichever team does something a bit exceptional, whether it's, you know, Messi or Mbappe or goalkeeping error, mistake, bad decision, it will be that tight, I think.
Yeah. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to watch. So, yeah, let's see. Morocco had a good run, though.
Yeah, to be frank, with a little bit more finishing and a little bit of a rub, they could have won that semi-final. Yeah, I felt for those lads because they put a great shift in, and quite a few of them there were playing with injuries. And I think, you know, they can take a lot from this. And the third place playoff tomorrow will be maybe as exciting as the final in some way, because they both actually want to win that. If it's like one of the countries that expect to win, Brazil, Germany or England or whatever, that they don't necessarily put the same level of effort in. But for either of those countries, certainly even more so for Morocco to pick up a bronze medal in, you know, third in the world, be marvellous. I mean, Croatia did come second last time, but they want to win that as well. So yeah, it should be two good games.
Right. Okay. So, you know, I just thought that we will end the year with an article that I've read. And it is an article talking about intuitive teaching. And I will share the article in the link, in the show notes, so that people can actually read the article, so that they get a bit of context to what we are talking about. But I just thought it was an interesting article. And it really talks about the importance, or not really so much the importance, about how many teachers, or many of us who identify as teachers, really practice what we call, or what the article says, is intuitive teaching. So let's start with that. What exactly is intuitive teaching based on your frame then?
Okay, well, when I read the article, it was interesting, but I also had a sense of kind of amusement, because
right,
this word intuition gets used in multifaceted ways, right? That okay, often people say, oh, I had a feeling about this, I had a gut reaction and whatever. And the thing about intuition is that we can look at it in many ways, in many contexts. Let me give you a couple of examples that in the case of people that are genuine experts, and if you remember, we had a conversation, I think, in one of the previous podcasts on expertise, and we referred to the work of, I think it was Atano and Iganaki, got that slightly wrong. And they were guys who talked about two types of expertise. One was routine expertise and the other one adaptive expertise. The interesting thing about adaptive expertise is that these are people that really know a subject well, but are very flexible and apply that vast knowledge range in new situations to new problems. Now, some people who are adaptive experts, they will almost have an unconscious competence. So it's almost intuitive. They're in a situation and they will process the information consciously, subconsciously, unconsciously, and they will come up with good problem-solving strategies. Point of view, you can say, well, intuition is a result of very deep expertise over time. However, Mark, and this is the paradox of this, there are also people who know virtually nothing about something but have an opinion on it, and that applies to a big percentage of the population, because let's be honest about it, very few people are experts anyway, And most people are real novices in most areas. I mean, how many people are politically literate? So when elections come by, how many people are familiar with what the political left means, the underlying assumptions about human nature, the theory of, for example, if you take the left wing point of view, it's based a lot on the work of Marx and Lenin. But if you said to people who would vote Labour or left wing, can you explain historical or dialectical materialism and how capitalism becomes a fetter on itself? You might as well be speaking kind of another language. And same thing, people, you know, start talking about the extreme right. But nobody really, when I speak to people and say, what exactly is the extreme right? They'll say, well, fascism. And then when I say, well, what does that mean? Oh, it's Nazism. In actual fact, the extreme right doesn't really have any consistent sociological model. To me, neither of those perspectives hold a lot of sway with me, because you know, to some extent, both tend to end up in a kind of tyranny or totalitarian society, as we've seen in many countries. Now, going back to the point of education, is that a lot of people think, oh, teaching's intuitive, right? Okay, so but if they know nothing really about all the research that's now gone on in the brain and the mind. So to them, oh, yeah, we just do this. Now, let's add one more thing to this. Now, yeah, we can say human beings intuitively know how to look after their young. Well, so do all other mammals and many other creatures. And we call that instinct. So you could say that's intuition. Now, this is a big point. Could we also say, if it's intuitive to teach, can we also say it's intuitive then to be a carer? Now, I would rather have somebody who is a trained doctor and surgeon looking after me than somebody who's learned simply to clean up a wound or, you know, kind of stick some bandage on me. So there's an interesting corollary to this as well, that our brain is the same now as it was probably 300,000 years ago, and certainly 50,000 years ago. If we go back 50,000 years, all we had to learn was, where do we find food? How do we cook it? And how to stop some nasty animal like a saber-toothed tiger from getting into our cave or campons and eating our children. So we didn't have to process a lot of knowledge then. So our brain and intuition was very sufficient to deal with the world of even a few hundred years ago. But now we are overloaded with information, but we've still got a Stone Age brain. And all we can do now is rely on the best knowledge about how the mind and the brain works. And that is much more than a very basic primitive intuition. So took up a bit of time there, but I think it's important to make the point that intuition can be based on high level expertise, but very often it's based on very naive, prejudiced opinion that goes back to very primitive notions of dealing with a simple, uncomplicated reality.
Okay, so then let's just ask, let's really answer the elephant in the room. So is intuitive teaching bad?
Is it bad?
Yes.
Considering
the fact that a majority, I would say, of teachers would be or would consider themselves to be intuitive teachers, just knowing what is working in the classroom, what's not, and based on their intuition and, as you mentioned, instinct. So my question is intuitive teaching bad?
Okay. Now, this is the thing, Mark, in life, that generally, you know, things exist in paradoxes. Let's give you an example. Let's just take an example and then we'll come back and unpack that. We know if we take behaviorist psychology, good old Bruce Skinner, right? Stimulus, response, reinforcement, right?
Yeah.
And we know that positive reinforcement, whether it's external or intrinsic reward, tends to lead to desired behaviors. For example, let's give an example today. It's Christmas and I was actually covering a couple of classes, right? And I thought to myself, well, it's Christmas, so I go in with a tin of chocolates, right?
Yeah.
And it's amazing how children's attention increases and their cognitive capability increases when, you know, there is a chocolate reward. And, you know, that's the dopamine factor coming in and the psychological factor, right? So we know that rewards positively shape behavior. And but we also know, don't we, that punishments do. In other words, you know, if we go back to a time, say, in the UK, when there was no real punishment for people drinking and driving, a lot of people did so. Now that there's big fines and there's 2 or 3 year bans, it stops people doing it. So what's better, punishment or reward? Well, we tend to know in an educational context that rewards tend to be better. But at the same time, sometimes you need to use punishment. So I don't think we can say all intuitive teaching is bad if it's based on expertise or a person is as developed just through the trial and error learning without putting a theory of learning on what they're doing, actually have a pretty good idea how to deal with people. So in itself, intuitive teaching could be okay, because I think that a lot of people would know where we're dealing with children, we need to try to understand how they think and feel, and we need to try to explain things in some way. So, you know, intuitive teachers can be okay, but I wouldn't call that expertise unless it was based on intuition that is heavily grounded in good research. Now, it is possible that somebody could be very expert at the technical knowledge area, but be quite unkind as a personality. So, and in that sense, if they know a lot about the subject but don't really like kids much and are generally impatient and unsympathetic to them, then maybe that expertise don't work. But I think we would agree that expert teachers have got to, one, be expert in terms of the way they design and facilitate learning, but also have certain character attributes, you know, to do with empathy, to do with care and concern, to do with a sense of wanting to help people develop. So, you know, that would be my response to that. Is it good or bad? Well, it can be bad, particularly if people have just learnt from teachers they've seen in the past who have spoken in monotone voices, you know, don't have any engagement, and the content is badly organised. If they have taken on that model, and that's a, you know, intuitive knowledge, that's a level of intuition, then that's not good.
Yeah, so I just want to go back and unpack a little bit of what you said. Intuitive teaching is okay if it's based on expertise. Now, there lies the problem, doesn't it? How do you know that whatever it is that they are basing it on is based on an empirically evidence-based kind of knowledge base in that sense? That's number one. Number two, can experience make up for expertise? For example, if you think about it, many teachers, you know, been teaching 30, 40 years. Now, if you ask them, they will probably be able to tell you some teaching methods are more effective than others. But if you ask them to relate it to a learning theory or why it is more effective than others, they probably aren't able to tell you, but intuitively, they can actually do it based on experience. So how do we reconcile that?
Okay, there's two questions there. Let's take the experience one first. Yeah. Right. Now, I think it's the work, in fact, I know it is, the work of Berlinger, who did a lot of research on experience and competence. And what Berlinger concluded was that you can have an hell of a lot of experience over many years and be totally incompetent. In other words, you've just learnt to do it badly and you consistently do it badly. And what he found is it's the people who are highly motivated to want to develop expertise who are keen to do research into the area and have good metacognitive capabilities who seem to develop expertise. Of course, they will need some experience, but I think the kind of notion is, and I think it fits my model of teaching, that, I mean, we've trained, you know, thousands of teachers and lecturers, whatever. And what I found is that when people have a very certain personality type, they're very open, they've got a curious mentality, they are really motivated to want to teach well, that with one is that they will learn very quickly, and with the right kind of knowledge provision and good feedback, become very good quite quickly. Equally, we will know there's people that whatever you do don't seem to ever develop an higher level of competence. So I wouldn't say experience only is going to create that high level of expertise and good intuitive teaching. But certainly, in some cases, there will be teachers who, through trial and error, and because they really want to learn and develop competence, even though they don't have a learning, right, or deep knowledge of cognitive psychology, evolved that understanding, that competence, that is possible through experience for teachers to have worked it all out without a practical framework. But it will probably have taken,
let's use an analogy, Mark.
Say me and you are in Singapore or any place in the world, any city, right? And we have to get to the airport, okay? Now, if we use our trial and error, we might be dead lucky and we just happen to pick that trajectory and we walk straight to the airport, and people say, oh, they had an intuitive understanding of how to get to the airport, they're really clever, okay? But the chances are we could probably weeks, days, months, the rest of our lives, and if the airport's 15 kilometers away, we may never find it, right? However, I use Google Maps, and a lot of the time I can't find places because it's not that clear. But when you have the perfect map, we are here and it says, get to here, look for this, look for that, then do this, and it's clear, we will get to that airport much quicker. And that's the way I kind of see the movement towards expertise in teaching. Yes, let people be themselves, they may end up very good teachers, it will take a while, or they don't end up good teachers. Whereas if you select teachers who have the right motivational personality aspects, good communication skills, people that are, if you like, suited to the demands of teaching, and you give them expert knowledge that's validated, let them digest it, apply it, deliberate, those people are likely to be pretty good teachers in a couple of years. It doesn't necessarily someone like that in 10,000 hours to varies, but what I'm saying is I've seen people become pretty good teachers over short periods of time. Equally, I've seen
and they're dreadful.
Right. Okay. So then how then can we support, because we are, after all, a podcast on evidence-based teaching and learning. So how then can we support these intuitive teachers who are keen to be to build expertise, to base their intuition on expertise, to be more evidence-based? How can we do that? How can we better support them?
Well, again, when we say intuitive teachers, I'm not even convinced it's a useful term, if you follow what I mean.
Okay.
Assumptional base of it, that are these teachers that, you know, call, are they people just keen? Are they people that are kind of perhaps a bit narcissistic? We don't know. I think, and it could range across those kind of dimensions. I mean, it's like that, and I'm like, really? Very often people who seem to have these sort of solutions to world problems, and you know, they've never read anything about it.
It's kind of worrying. So
you could have teachers say, oh, I know how to teach, you know, I know everything about human personality and whatever, and I just know what to do. Well, maybe So, you know, it's a little bit worrying. Fine, if teachers say to me, I think I have a good intuitive understanding of people, I would say, well, okay, well, tell me what you think you know. And, you know, tell me what you think that means in terms of how you design teaching, how you do an highly challenging job with different personalities and try to get them to excel in terms of attainment, build motivation, those kind of things. And if they can tell me, so, well, yeah, you are intuitive and you have you have acquired good pedagogic knowledge through experience. You can get very good at something. You don't have to read textbooks or go to university. I think a lot of professional footballers can be excellent coaches without having the ice
qualifications
in coaching, right? Okay. I mean, I know people who've got kind of coaching qualifications, but I still wouldn't say they're good coaches. And equally, I know people that don't have those qualifications, but have good knowledge of football. And let's be honest about it. It's a fairly simple game, isn't it? You get the ball and you pass it and there's some rules. And a lot of it is about teamwork and strategy. And, you know, I think we can over...
strategy.
You know, when we watch football matches and manager makes a substitution and a substitution comes on and scores, oh, what a marvellous decision. Well, yeah, of course it looks that way, but equally if that player would have not scored and put the ball over the bar, you know, Harry Kane penalty this week, right? What a shocking decision. Now, I actually thought, looking back, you know, to bring a bit of football in, as we need to occasionally, is that I would not have wanted Harry Kane to take two penalties in a game if I would have been Gareth Southgate. Two reasons. One is, you know, they play for the same club. So Lloris would know where Kane tends to put the ball, right?
Yeah.
And Kane probably has two or three preferred slots. So Lloris would think, well, he's probably going to use these. So he's got a one in a three chance of possibly getting it. Now, having scored the first one, then psychologically with Harry Kane, he might be thinking, well, I better not put it in the same position because he knows I like that. So I could put it somewhere else, but then Lloris might be thinking that I'm not going to put it in the same position. I'm going to put it in that other preferred position. And that's just enough to create a bit of imbalance. And what happened in the end, he whacks it over the bar. Now, you know, a world-class footballer doesn't get the ball on target. You know, you talked about Bukayo Saka and Sancho and people like that, you know, who took penalties in the Euros. They did at least get the ball on target. It just wasn't a particularly well-struck penalty. To put it, what, a couple of feet over the bar? Something was not right there. And I think, again, that's where, you know, decisions are made. Now, should I would have not had Harry Kane taking two penalties against his own keeper.
Yeah.
But, you know, Gareth Southgate's getting paid $8 million a year. I don't know what he gets. And, you know, and I'm sitting there, you know, talking about football to you. So, you know, I can have a good understanding of football simply because, like you, we've played it and it ain't that complicated. To do the skillful movements on the field, that's different. But our understanding of football, in many respects, is probably as good as people who've got full coaching badges or, you know, people who've played professional football. So, we, you know, that's just a comparison point.
Right. So can I suggest that in order for them to really start to be a bit more evidence-based is to understand what they don't know? And I think maybe my question would be is they are already starting from a base of, I would suppose, some form of motivation because they are relying on their intuition. They're trying to do a good job. So how then can we better support them to be more evidence-based? And I'm going to link this to what the article says. And the author says that actually most teachers prefer to remain instinctive or intuitive because once they have a cognitive dissonance or when they find out that there's a problem, it is quite difficult to change. Now, do you agree with this assertion?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, it's all very dangerous, isn't it? That the, you know, if we're kind of turning around and saying that, oh, well, let them just stay with that intuition. How many times, you know, if you look at military history, for example, where you look back on it and the, you know, the person, the commanding chief, you know, who sends the troops over the top or not over the top, how very often it's just been based on kind of pure ego or narcissism, and you know, loads of people have been killed. So I don't have any idea of giving too much credence to intuition without verification. Now, for example, the way I would look at it, look, have you listened to people talking about, you know, when someone's ill when they go to the doctors, and if you listen to conversations of other people, oh, it's definitely this, oh, I think it's that, I've gone on the internet, and 99% of the time they're wrong. Now, if they get it right, I told you so, you know, I've got good intuition. So, you know, it's like betting on football or betting on horse racing. Now, if we now knew top trainers, horse racing, dog racing stables, and they were really open and honest with us, and we went with their tips, and because they know the fitness of the dogs and how things are really happening, we'd win more money than the guy who goes in the bookies and says, I've got a gut reaction that you know, that Red Ruby's going to win the 220 at Newmarket. Well, if it wins, he's, oh, look at that. See, I've got great intuition. But the times that those guys get it right compared to the times that they get it wrong, probably, if they were that good, the bookmakers would go out of business, wouldn't they?
Yeah, precisely.
So, you know, kind of, you know, for example, I predicted, and I actually said to people, if you want to have a bet, bet on Uruguay to beat, was it Ghana?
Yep.
Yeah, Ghana. It was Ghana, wasn't it? Yeah. And the reason I did that was, you could say, oh, it's my gut reaction, intuition, but it was based on this, Mark, and was that I looked at the Uruguay defence and I thought, this is a good defence. It will deal with the Jordan Ayew and what's it called, Ayew, because I've seen him in the Premiership. They're decent players, but yep. I think that Uruguayan defence will handle them. But I also thought that you've got Cavani, you've got, what's his name?
Suarez.
Suarez, who were world class, as in world class finishers, and you've got the new Liverpool guy Nunes, who looks world class. So even an aging Suarez, Cavani, and a young Nunes with a good Uruguayan defence would get chances against that Gambian defence, and that's exactly what happened. Now, was that great intuition, or was that, you know, very good analysis of players' capabilities, football tactics, situated context? I think, yeah, that was good intuition, but it was based on something. I just wish I would have put £100,000 on it rather than 20 quid, you know, kind of thing. So there you go.
But your intuition will probably tell you it's a bad idea to put $100,000 on a game like that.
Well, it all depends on whether I can afford to lose $100,000, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah, I know. But what I'm saying is, it was that, but it was the. If. Are those. They. I've got a lot of insider knowledge, one, which helps. Secondly, a really good ability to analyze the.
Like, we guarantee him to win.
But those people are more likely, if you gave them, you know, $1,000 at the end of the year, to perhaps have more than $1,000 to somebody who knows nothing about football. And
my guys are playing in blue. I like blue.
I'm not going to back them. You know?
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, joke. You can tell a joke.
Okay. It's a man and his wife. And you could reverse the roles, wife and man. Here, there's two people, right? And they're at a dog track, and one person goes.
There's a racing. All this
goes with is her partner. I don't want to get caught up in any gender issues on this. It's Yeah, the other one has never been to a dog racing track, knows nothing about dog racing, right? And they're at the racetrack. Anyhow, the person who is, you know, the person who supposedly knows a lot about dog racing has got the racing post and is looking at the program and what this dog. And the other person's got no idea and says, oh, I'm going to have the dog number. In dog racing, there's usually six dogs and number five dog, right? And the person who knows a lot about it says to the other,
I'm right.
Okay. Anyway. They both have their bets, and the person who knows nothing sticks with the number five. Anyway, it comes around and wins, right? Anyway, the person loses, and this goes on for two or three races. The person keeps saying, I want the five dog, I want, and the other person saying, no, well, I can't see that. You know? Anyway, so there's been seven races. The person who knows nothing about it has had the number five dog every race, and it's won. And the other person said, look, it's the last race coming up. I suppose you want the number four. And the person says, no, because I think it's tied by now. Now, think they're all different dogs, you know, but what I'm saying is the person's just super lucky. So what I'm saying is, you know, are you going to then turn around and say, oh, that person's got good intuition? Now, you know, you could be super lucky. When you go into classrooms with things, you could behave randomly and, you know, you might get two or three things right. But if you behave randomly, eventually it'd be chaos, wouldn't it?
Yeah, precisely. So I think then maybe the question would be, can reflective practice, and I think we did talk about this in previous episodes, can evidence-based reflective practice help intuitive teachers get over this hurdle of if they are wrong, you know, it is still possible to become... to build expertise based on evidence rather than on intuition?
It would depend on their personality type. This is the thing that kind of worries me. We know, Mark, let's be honest, we, you know, that when we, in going on in society at the moment, there is a kind of cultural war going on. It's certainly going on in the UK. There is a cultural war, and it really is quite dangerous. You've got on one hand people that from a sociological perspective we would call they're social constructivists, right? And these people believe that everything about humanity, you know, gender, all of this kind of stuff, inequality, blah blah blah, is a result of culture and socialization. And we live in a society that has been historically dominated by men, in particular white men, and it is their role. And you've probably heard of wokeism, haven't you?
Yeah.
Right. And these are people that are saying that kind of, and they believe in kind of critical race theory that, you know, white men are, you know, historically oppressive, and it's their role to counsel and change history and lay down this political correctness and, you know, and have a world where everything is socially constructed. We're going to create, you know, multiple identities and genders, and everybody's going to be equal. And then you've got we did a podcast on Jordan Peterson, didn't we, once, you know, about the rules of life. And, you know, he's one of the advocates that are, you know, dismisses or challenges this view. And it's not just him, there's an increasing number of people who say, hold on a minute, look, you know, this is dangerous nonsense that, okay, we want to have equal opportunity in society, we want our freedom of speech, but what we're getting with the social constructivists is that their model has no empirical based on it at all, and they are more totalitarian than, you know, even fascist societies. I mean, for example, you could say, you know, if you go
totalitarian,
if you step out of line, you're going to get bashed, right? Whereas,
yeah,
if you challenge this social constructivist view of reality and say, well,
I don't care about these issues. To me. Well, anyway, we don't
have to have these constant, you know,
appropriate saying them
on that you will get
a job or you won't get a job. And there's a lot
of evidence to, you know, to suggest
hotel in British culture of the Western society. So now, let's translate it into education, right? There is,
yeah,
you know, just need to recognize that every student
go in and be creative,
and you know, because
which, as you know,
you know, I critique pretty heavily in my books, and not to deny that people are individuals and they, you know, they make sense in their own way, but there's more universality to the way the brain works, and you know, the kind of underpinning human nature does exist, that, you know, there are differences between people, but that doesn't make it one of this, you know, one is better than the other. I mean, this constant nonsense that goes on about men and women, men being better than women, or to me, it's an irrelevant argument. If there's differences, so what? You know, for example, most violent criminals are men. So does that make men worse than women? It just means that they're more likely to get involved in physical violence. Look at some all the hooligans that got involved in were men. How many groups of women go out fighting with women? That's not to say that some women don't fight, but there's less even confrontation other ways, and there's a lot of evidence to show that, you know, female aggression caught up in them making one
it is different,
and we have to accept that, you know,
there are better ways of conducting
other, as opposed to
I just go in and do
by that.
Yeah, okay, so then maybe okay, so we have more or less established that intuition or instinctive teaching should be from an expertise point of view. But I was just wondering, you know, some of the stories that you've been sharing, and since you've been teaching for quite a number of years, do you have any that comes across or comes to mind of anybody you know that was such an intuitive and instinctive teacher and got so much results, and you wondered, how did they do that even if they didn't have the relevant expertise?
The answer, quite simply, is no, because this is in... No, really, really, Mark, and I'll give reasons, right? I've seen... Yeah. We've trained loads of teachers. You know, like, sometimes we have a competency-based model of teaching. We have to tick boxes. Is it clear? Is the font size and whatever? I've seen teachers who on the competency checklist... You would fail, you know, you couldn't read the text, or, you know, they've tripped over the OHP, or, you know, they dropped in an inappropriate word, whatever that means, you know, like, whatever, right? But their ability to engage the students and for those students to feel, wow, this teacher really is making an effort, I get it. I've seen teachers who have passed professional teaching qualifications, oh, I wouldn't employ any day of the week. And I've seen other teachers who have not done as well on the, you know, the criteria reference bit, but I think I will employ you all day long. Now, but the thing is, what those teachers are doing is still doing stuff that's evidence-based. In other words, teaching is as much a acts of communication. I mean, Carl Rogers talked about, you know, it's about, you know, that kind of positive relationship. It's as much an emotional and an affective activity as it is a cognitive one. Daniel Willingham talks about, you know, students judging their teachers based on, is the teacher well organized, and is the teacher a nice person? So what I would say is that expert teachers are well organized, which means they, whether they've developed it through trial and error over many years, or whether they've learned it from cognitive science and good teacher education, and are nice people, and I'm saying people that are kind, people that are empathic, people that have care and concern, people that are self-critical, those kind of people are the, you know, the gold standard of teaching. And I think those kind of attributes apply right across, you know, all fields of work.
That's what I would say. So, you know, I don't think using intuitive teaching as a model is of any pedagogic use. It's a bit like our learning styles. How many teachers are still going into classrooms and say, I've got to cater to their learning styles? You know, intuitively, you might feel that students have different learning styles because then some are learning when you talk and some don't learn. The truth of it is, as we know, you know, from an evidence-based point of view, from research, that learning styles doesn't exist and it's potentially very dangerous. But a lot of people intuitively think learning styles. Now, there's a lot of people who claim to have been abducted by aliens. I don't think they have. So I don't really trust people's subjectivity that much. Yes, people have subjective experience, and we, you know, at the end of the day, we've got to be careful about kind of dismissing subjective experience because we all have it. But I think some subject experience holds up better in the real world. There is an objective reality out there. The truth is out there. We can never totally know it. But we do know, I think, that human beings suffer. I don't think we need to say, oh, suffering doesn't exist. It's just purely a state of mind. I don't think it is. We know that the laws of physics, okay, might not apply everywhere in the universe, but, you know, we don't jump off of buildings expecting to land on our feet from, you know, 20,000 feet. Or, you know, when planes come down and crash from 20,000 feet, people don't just walk off the plane, do they?
It depends if you're in the matrix, if you believe that there is a matrix.
When you see teachers who go in and, you know, they're shouting at students and they're disorganized and they're being unkind unnecessarily, when you speak to those students don't say, oh, that's a wonderful teacher. Now, you can be strict. Yeah. Some students might not like that. So, oh, this teacher's really strict. But if that teacher is fair and the kids are learning, they might say, oh, I don't like, you know, Dennis Sauer, Mark, you know, Niven Singh, but yeah, I'm learning. If people are going in and they're very nice to the students, but the students not learning anything, you know, they say he's a cracking bloke or, you know, nice lady, but not learning anything. But those teachers are able to pull those two things together where they can manage the classroom without having to use a lot of punishments or minimal punishments and be able to come across as a nice person and well organized. I mean, you know, those people are better than those that are badly organized and not very nice people. And I've seen teachers who are not well organized and quite simply of the wrong personality type. They should never be in the classroom. Put those two things together and that's really, yeah,
recipe for disaster.
Good luck with employing teachers like that.
Yeah. So let's wrap up this segment by maybe just asking you then your thoughts on, so how can we let's not kid ourselves, whether we like it or not, a lot of our teacher friends and colleagues would still rely on some form of instinct or intuition. We can't deny that. So how can we then help them, or how can evidence-based teaching go hand in hand with intuitive teaching? What should we do?
Now that gets towards a better framing thing. Yeah. We want teachers to be intuitive at the level of being in situ and be able to understand the situation. Like, for example, you've got a lesson plan, you've gone in and you can see the students are not engaged, there's something wrong. So, see, I'm seeing good intuition bound up with good sensory acuity. So, you know, intuitively, a good teacher, whether they've learnt it by trial and error or whether they understand human behaviour and pedagogy. I mean, we know that we can go in the classroom and, you know, the students at different ages, you know, because of the different maturational levels or things that have gone on previously or there's been some conflict in the group, that students are not a uniform entity, right? When we put the kettle on, we know the water's going to boil at, you know, 100 degrees centigrade, I think, doesn't it? That kind of thing. Yeah. And whereas with students, they, you know, you just get times when they're just, some of them are just not in a good mood, or they're in a or they can be in a very, you know, students who generally could be a bit morose could be in a good mood. So it's the ability to read the situation. So I would say that's good. Sensory acuity. I have a intuitiveness that helps me to read the situation, but equally I could say I've got an expertise to read it. So let's have those who are, you know, intuitive in terms of trying to understand the situation and just think how better they are if they're genuinely got good sensory acuity and want to read situations. You imagine they've got expert knowledge about learning, about the way students think and feel, and how to use technology to enhance that. You put that on good sensory acuity, and then you've got a very expert intuitive teacher, right?
Right.
If you want to play around with that term, but just to say they're intuitive, you know, without just making decisions. Oh, I see this. Well, yeah, okay. If you are seeing something else,
intuitive, but you've
got an underpinning
there of seeing something
and feeling something, haven't you? Good psychotherapist, right? Okay. Good psychotherapist. Because so to pick up on non, you know, changes in,
right,
you know, though it still comes a competence or skill set,
right? Okay, so that nicely ends that segment. So let's move on to, as I always said, my favorite part of the podcast, which is part two, where we share a thought, a reading, a book, or maybe even a documentary or a video that we have come across. So what could be something that you would recommend then for someone to think about before the end of the year is up?
Well, whatever in the last couple of weeks, honest about it, I'm noticing more things that are going on in society that worry me than any specific article. What worries me is a lack of good thinking across populations and across societies, and more. You've only got to look at the world, listen to the news, and you know, you could go on and on and on. I think there's a real need for we try and improve teachers, right? And to me, I'm seeing more evidence-based teaching or evidence-based creative teaching as much a political and a social philosophical thing as it is a cognitive thing. I mean, you imagine if we had across the world, doesn't matter what the political status of the society is, what it would, because some political systems wouldn't allow us to have freedom of thought and thinking, would they? But if we had teachers who were genuinely committed to getting students to think better, to really understand the human condition, and I think massive changes need in the curriculum. We're teaching stuff that is tertiary. Students need to learn more about how their minds work, how their brains work, how societies work. I think, you know, that's got to be a key area of curriculum knowledge, because we need students who are better thinkers in order to solve the kind of complex problems that we've got now. So to me, I'm more and more coming around to, let's try to affect teachers globally so that they get students to think better globally. I see that as maybe even more relevant than the environmental issues, because if we got people to think better, they would deal with those issues as well better. So, you know, that's my big, if you like, well, ain't a big insight specifically to these last couple of weeks. It's been emerging, but more I look at the world, more I think is, well, what's going to happen? You know, are we going to have a nuclear war? Are we going to have this kind of catastrophe? Are we going to have just more and more crime, more and more, you know, mental illness? There's something that systemically has to change, and that's what I think is developing people that are more self-regulated, more aware of human issues, and are able to communicate and collaborate better, and are better critical and creative thinkers, all these kind of things. And, you know, maybe as human beings, we're just simply not well enough evolved to actually do this, and therefore we may be extinct in 100 years' time, or maybe we, you know, we can transcend that. I'm starting to think more in those kind of macro terms, and it's a challenge. And sometimes we just say to ourselves, why are we doing this? You know, let's just go and play porn, go fishing, you know, on some tropical islands rather than be part of some, you know, betterment of, or, you know, in Steven Pinker's term, some kind of, you know, enlightenment.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just speaking as I feel about things, you know.
Okay. So, a bit serious for the end of year message.
Yeah, well, at the same time, you know, yeah. Our whole show is to be serious, to be evidence-based, to look at teaching, but yeah. Also to recognise that, you know, you have to sometimes add humour. And as I've said many times, that, you know, humour is about best defence against nature. So, you know, it's another paradox that we, you know, to some extent you've got to laugh at life, but you've also got to take it serious, and it's a set of paradoxes, isn't it?
Yeah. Okay. So I wanted to just share something that I was reading as an article. It's not an edu tech tool this week, because I was revisiting the idea of differentiated instruction, trying to understand a little bit deeper what could be some successful strategies. I don't have the website link with me on hand, but I will put it in the show notes so that you can actually read the full quote. But in differentiating instruction, there are four ways in which we can differentiate instruction: through the content, through the process, through the product, or through the learning environment. But this particular article author was saying that actually teachers shouldn't spend too much time trying to do all four, but to just focus on the process, which is to think about how their teaching methods can help meet students' learning needs. And that was something that I thought was particularly interesting for me, because for the longest time, I've always been thinking of, oh, we need to look at how we can differentiate the content. Oh, we need to look at how we can differentiate the product. Oh, we need to look at how we can give students choice. Oh, we need to look at how we need to change the environment to suit their preferences and so forth. But that article, I think, brought a refreshing, it was quite refreshing to think about, well, if you as a teacher can control the way you look at your teaching methods, then that should be the key and the goal towards differentiated instruction. Yeah, so I thought that was quite interesting for me. Your thoughts then? Do you think...
Because I think we can kind of try to fragment things so much that you don't get the holism that, you know, if you take that differentiation, is you're trying to, with the resources, use the learning process to give people access. And that's where I think technology is pretty good in differentiation, because if you can create the hyperlinks and you've got the good pedagogic knowledge, you can, and if we're getting students to become more agentic learners, they understand the learning process, then for those students who are exceeding the learning outcomes for a given program and who want to go further, and then we can say, well, you know, here's some resources, you know, they've got good thinking skills, go with it. And they, because that's what independent learning is all about, isn't it? And equally for those students who are learning at a slower pace and need more concrete examples and more deliberate practice, we can set up stuff for them. We don't have to fragment it into these dimensions. Is this going to help these students to move up some mastery, whether it's playing a musical instrument or whether it's being able to analyze things in a novel? So, yeah, totally. We are overcomplicating lots of things in education. And you know, I'm going to be philosophical again. You know, I think we do that in life. And that's why so many people today are confused and anomic. You know, one thing I learned, you know, in developing kind of therapeutic techniques is that ultimately, you know, what Charles Mingus said as a statement, that kind of there is a natural tendency to make the simple complicated, whereas creativity is making the complicated simple, awesomely simple. And I think we can use that model in terms of how we teach. If you talk about values, I find in the UK and other countries, you know, they're trying to deal with issues of human conduct, you know, through political correctness and inquiry and cancelment and, you know, constantly stating the obvious. I mean, you know, when I saw the English players taking the knee in the World Cup, I thought, hold on a minute. You know, 40 years ago, lives matter, you know, and all of a sudden, like, we're suddenly saying, oh, well, Black Lives, of course they do. You know, all lives matter. We all know that. But by keep talking about it, it, you know, it's like a Shakespearean thing, me think he doth protest too much. So I think we should get back to core values. And that's what I did like about Singapore. And I say this here and people get a bit sick of me sometimes. You know, let's get back to, you know, things like kindness, graciousness, respect, responsibility. Let's talk about those things rather than this constant entitlement and rights and do what you want. You know, it's kind of, don't really like that too much. So yeah, totally get that one.
Okay, so yeah, and that really brings us to the end of 2022. It's been a wild ride. It's been great. I can't even remember what episode we are at. We'll continue to churn these episodes out. So we do hope, and we thank you if you have been listening to us for the whole of 2022. We do intend to continue to 2023. We are, right, Dan? We are intending to continue to 2023.
Yeah, yeah. I do think that more people who get involved and are prepared to challenge assumptions and look at the evidence, and also recognize that you can find bits of evidence for different things. So that's the interesting thing about this debate. What we're looking for is to get the best level of quality thinking with the best evidence, but always be prepared for some falsification. You know, the classic Popper term. Let's not everything we've got the ultimate picture. Let's get better pictures of reality, better pictures of what sort of society could be like, what good teaching is, and what is the best evidence, and keep playing around with that. And I think, you know, more people that get involved in that dialogue, then we'll have a betterment of understanding and therefore practice.
Perfect. So yeah, thank you very much for listening to us. And if you do want to be part of the podcast, or even just to drop us a message, you can do so at evidencebasedcreativeteaching@gmail.com. Once again, it is evidencebasedcreativeteaching@gmail.com. And that's 2022, and it's a wrap. So thank you very much again for listening to us, and we'll talk to you probably in 2023. Have a good, blessed holiday, and we'll speak to you soon. So take care and goodbye.
Yeah, and the same from me. Have a good break, and whatever meaning you make of Christmas, then